Now, Emma Race, I don't know about you, but I love my women's football. Are you into your women's sport?
You tell me how many times you've burnt your sports bra, and I'll tell you how many times I've burnt my sports bra, and we'll compare.
Well, there is a fantastic new book out that I think we are both very into. We've been fighting over the one copy that we've got here. It's called Never Say Die, The 100-Year Overnight Success of Australian Women's Football. And one of the authors has been good enough to join us. Lee McGowan, welcome to Grand National on the ABC.
Thanks very much for having me.
Lee, congratulations on the book, for starters. This is a history of women's football in Australia. Where does it start? Are you able to put your finger on the first ever game of women's soccer in Australia?
Hey, Matt, look, there's a few stories being reported in the press when you go back through Trove and stuff. So there was teams possibly formed in 1903 in Sydney. Then there was maybe a quiet game in South Australia in 1912, one in 1916 in Sydney too. But really the kind of first big public match event, you know, where the that was advertised, where people were openly invited, was the game at the Gabba in September in 1921. The crowd estimates were 10,000 people came to watch that game.
Lee, I'm so thrilled to have you on the show today because I just want to listen to you all day long. Can you just tell us, where is that accent from, my friend? Is it Colombian?
Yeah, that's right, Colombian, yeah. It's actually, well, it sounds Colombian because I'm from a small Colombian commune just outside Glasgow.
Right.
Lee, we've always butchered the title of this beautiful world game. We call it soccer, we call it football. When did we call it football back in 1903 and 1921 when you've discovered these women's teams?
They called it three different names. So they called it soccer, they called it football, soccer, and they called it association football or British association football.
Oh.
So the game's formally called Brisbane. See, that's one of the things I don't understand about being in Australia, to be honest. I often say this to people, you know, we live in a country where a red-backed spider's called a red-backed spider because it's got a red back. A blue-tongued lizard's called a blue-tongued lizard because it's got a blue tongue, right? 75-mile beach. And yet, rugby union, rugby league and Aussie rules are all called football and football's called soccer. Go tell me how that works. That's ridiculous.
Sorry to confuse you. These are some, these are some of the questions we ask on our citizenship
Lee, there's a beautiful photo of the team from 1921. Can you?
Yeah.
Were you the person that discovered it? Can you take us back to the moment?
Look, There's a photograph. This was really funny. There's a photograph that's been around for a while of the Latrobe team. They were the first women's team to have their photograph taken in Australia, as far as we know. And so you can get that on Wikipedia, you know, on the Wik. But the photo we discovered that we got excited about is the 1922 team, the Brisbane Brisbane City Ladies Football Club, I think it is. So that was the one we were pretty excited about because obviously that tells us there was a football team in Brisbane in 1922, which is obviously after the ban in England as well. So that was a really exciting find. And I found it in a box full of other broken picture frames covered in cocky poo and, you know, like all sorts of stuff. So it was pretty exciting, honestly, to find that. I know it's kind of geeky, but it was pretty exciting.
There are some great photos in the book, which is called Never Say Die. I know in the UK, Lee, that women's football really came to prominence during World War One when a lot of the blokes were off fighting, but people still wanted to watch football. So the women started playing and attracted some really big crowds through that period. Was there a similar effect here in Australia?
Well, it's quite interesting because they were called the Munitionettes. So women's football really started in 1916 in England. The factory owners spied their workforce, which had obviously changed dramatically through the war, playing football out in the yard and thought, we can sell tickets for this. Because obviously, running up to the war, football had become the working class game. It had become a kind of national obsession, you know, and so there was a loss in the cultural landscape. Football went missing almost. most. And so this was an opportunity for them to bolster their revenues by selling games, selling tickets to games. And so there would be 1920 Boxing Day, there was a crowd of 53,000 watched two women's teams playing in England. A couple of weeks later, that was at Goodison Park and Everton's ground, and then 3 weeks later, I think 35,000 people watched two women's teams playing at Old Trafford, which is Manchester United's ground, you know. And so the crowds there were massive. They were really big in France at the same time as well. And obviously news of that stuff filtered through to Australia, which is where we see things really picking up in 1921. You have that game here in Brisbane, 10,000 people at it. 3 weeks later, there was a game at Ipswich here in South Queensland as well. The population at Ipswich was only 20,000 at the time, but 3,000 of them turned up to watch two Ipswich teams, women's teams, headline a carnival day to play football. So then in Sydney, 7,000 turned up to watch teams playing and later in the 1920s. Actually, around the same period, I think a crowd of 30,000 watched two women's teams playing rugby league as well in Sydney. So people were really keen to get out and watch women play sport.
After the 1920s, did women's football, soccer, go on a kind of four-decade hiatus? What happened, Lee?
So the biggest obstacle to women's football has been old white men, and this seems to be a recurring pattern all through the history of the game. In 1921, having raised hundreds of thousands of pounds for returning servicemen, the English Football Association determined to ban women from playing football. Not ban them from playing football, because obviously people can choose to do whatever they want to do, but just ban them from playing on English Football Association grounds. So they could play football, just not anywhere that you could play football. And so so that obviously had a huge impact, and there was a number of reasons for that. The first was that was put forward was, it could be damaging for your reproductive organs, you know, and we can't have that. Then obviously there's the kind of unseemliness of watching women run around a football pitch was raised as an issue as well. Then the money, because can you imagine, like, the revenue from a gate of 53,000 people would have been quite substantial. And in my mind, I see this image of these stogie smoking factory owners, you know, sitting around going, where's all that money going? And the women were just giving it to charity, as I said, returning servicemen. Then in the latter half of 1921 in England, the mines had been handed back to the landowners, you know, and so the first thing that the landowners did was cut the wages of the miners. So they all went on strike, and the women, predominantly Northern English women, started raising money to support the families of the striking miners. So you can imagine, besides the fact that they're giving the money away, now there's a kind of political argument as well. And so those are the reasons for the ban. So having banned them then, that was them done. So women turned to other things, obviously, because women were being actively encouraged to take part in sport, but just so long as it was sport that was kind of aesthetically appropriate. So in Australia in the early 1920s, say from 23, 24 onwards, what you have is an explosion in the recruitment numbers of hockey, women's basketball, which has been called netball since the 1970s, and a sport called Vigoro as well, which was a new one on me. I hadn't ever heard of that until we started doing the research. And the commonality across those three sports is the wearing of a skirt. So you can see how that kind of ban has had an impact on the sport. It didn't stop women from playing football here, though. You know, we've started documenting a kind of richer history of when football took place.
We're speaking to Lee McGowan, who's a soccer expert. He's written Never Say Die along with Fiona Crawford, which is the 100-year overnight success of Australian women's football. You're clearly passionate about women's football, and just hearing you talk about the injustice in the way that there were bans placed on women playing that were kind of being handed down from what the UK was doing, I'm intrigued to know, white men have been responsible for these bans that they were putting on women's football, but they also have been the keepers of the stories of football and soccer and history books over time. You're changing that circumstance by being so passionate and writing about football. Why? Why do you love women's sports so much?
It started for me with my two girls. She's my eldest is coming up for 17, and my youngest's 12. And so we're going to watch the W League games. And my eldest said to me, this is about 4 or 5 years ago, she said to me, Dad, why are the women's footballers not as good as the men? And I had to think, obviously, because I'm like a wee fat Scottish dad from a housing estate in central Scotland. Do you know, I hadn't even been aware, you know. And so I said, that's probably because the women work all week. They maybe train a couple of nights a week. Then they play football on a Saturday. They have to pay their own way, you know. And even as I was saying things like, you know, I said, whereas the men have a full-time wage to play football. They train 4 days a week, maybe two sessions a day. They have dietitians and physiotherapists and masseuses and trainers. And as this kind of explanation was rolling off my tongue, I started to think, geez, it's not fair, is it? It's really not fair. And so the co-author, Fiona Crawford, who is also an incredibly passionate advocate for the sport, as well, and had been involved in it for much longer than me, you know. So she introduced me to a few people as well, and so we've started to kind of build this picture. But my youngest was always like, so how long have they played for, Dad? When did they start and all that? So between the two girls and Fiona, I've started to realise, and especially the two girls, see the world through their eyes a bit more, you know, and understand the challenges that they face, and by extension of that, the challenges that women face, women elite female athletes face as well, which is just, it's ridiculous when you think about what the male players take for granted.
What do players like Sam Kerr and Megan Rapinoe do for your daughters?
Oh, well, you know, my youngest's favourite player is actually Claire Polkinghorne, who is the epitome of everything that women's football is about for me, you know, persistence, resilience, and she's just so genuine and lovely and just brilliant with my youngest. There was a video of the two of them catching up just before the Women's World Cup, you know, because my wee one breaks into tears every time she meets her. She's just so overwhelmed. But, you know, like, I think, we were over at the Women's World Cup and we were leaving Lyon after the final, and the American team were in the departure lounge as we were leaving Lyon at the same time as well. And the impact that Megan Rapinoe and Alex Morgan and those players around them is just incredible. Like, they were in one room surrounded by glass, and the all sides of the glass were obviously fishbowl, like, you know, everybody was just crammed against the window. My youngest was on her hands and knees, crawling between people's legs, taking photographs of the players and stuff. You know, it was amazing. And obviously, Sam Kerr's just incredible. I mean, imagine 2 years ago if someone said to you, yeah, a female Australian footballer's going to be making $1 million a year, people would just have laughed at you. She's just won the Golden Boot again in the US League. She's probably going to go to one of the top teams in Europe to play next year. You know, sure, we'll miss her from the W League, but I mean, she's going to a league where she's going to be treated as the caliber of player that she is. You know, like, whereas here in the W League, they're still treated like second-class citizens to a large extent. And so you can imagine, should I play on a pitch surrounded by a fence in Melbourne, or could I go and play in Chelsea Stadium? Yeah. I wonder which one I would choose.
Yeah. You know? It's a tough call, isn't it?
She doesn't have to mow the pitch beforehand either.
That's right. Or make her own way there. Yeah. You know, like, I...
Speaking of World Cups, I'm going to put you in a time machine and flip you forward to 2023. Australia plays Scotland in a qualifying match. Who do you go for?
Emma, that's cruel. You can't. I have an Australian passport. I mean, obviously my accent indicates how Australian I am. Actually, I've got a certificate to prove I'm Australian, so nana. But Scotland is my obviously where I was born. That's the country I love. So I would be completely torn. But honestly, I live with three fanatical Matildas fans in my house. It would be a difficult one. I think I'd probably go for Scotland as much to stir them up as anything else. But obviously, I would love to see the Matildas win the World Cup on home soil. I think that would just be incredible for the game's development here, you know, and women's sport as a whole, if I'm honest.
It would be amazing. There's no doubt about that. Well, the book is called Never Say Die, The 100-Year Overnight Success of Australian Women's Football. Lee McGowan, we really appreciate your time here on Grand National.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. And as well, having a captive audience just to listen to me is absolutely fantastic.
We'll sit here all day and listen to you, Lee.
Have your daughters all switched off, Lee?
Oh, aye, for sure. No, right. No, honestly, like, how cool is it to be doing something that my 16-year-old daughter is really proud of? Yeah. You know, like, I can't, like, that's me in the dad business now. I've just ticked a massive box here.
You've unlocked the code, Lee. thanks for your time, mate. We really appreciate it.
No, thank you.